All right, let's talk about the state of the Republicans. You know, there's little question that the Republican Party is now the party of Trump. But Republicans also used to stand for things, for fiscal responsibility, for controlling the debt, for balanced budgets, for strong world leadership, for the importance of alliances, for free trade, for law and order, for less government. And a lot of those positions are not exactly what Trump has strongly advocated. There is now very strong loyalty to Trump, regardless of what he does. Are the Republicans making the right decision by putting all of their chips on Trump, win or lose? And considering the demographic changes that are taking place in this country, will it cost the Republican Party the future?
Oh, is that, where's that going?
I mean, I think that—
Short-term, yes. Short-term, good. Bad term, long-term, bad.
Well, I think the long-term trend is still bad demographically for the Republican Party. They did that autopsy report after Mitt Romney lost that showed, among other things, that if they don't reach out to more people of color in this country, they're not going to survive as a party. Trump showed something different, that he could tap into a lot of people's fears who feel left behind in some fashion and actually and unearth more voters, more Republican voters. He combined that populism with kind of tried and true conservatism about social issues, embrace of evangelicals, and the courts, above all else the courts, the control of the future of the Supreme Court. And it's so motivating to core, particularly social conservative voters, he was able to bring all of them together. I think he's been pretty adept at, if you look at the business class in this country, whether it's less regulation or tax cuts, corporate tax cuts in particular, and then his general position toward the press and his opposition, I think that there's, that there's a lot of support there. So my question is really the future of conservatism. Because I don't know that, I think Barack Obama was kind of a singular sensation on the left. And that's one of the problems that the Democrats have. I think that's true with Trump. I don't know how you replicate him, but there's some, so my question is about the future of conservatism and of his brand of populism in someone else. I don't know.
So I think that Republicans, some of them who have been tried and true conservatives on a number of the issues you mentioned, look at President Trump and see the canvas that they want to see. In other words, they look at the justices and judges and they say, this is a great thing from my perspective as a conservative. They look at less regulation. They look at the tax structure. They look at the efforts that are being made for businesses to change the environmental situation. And then they look at, so there's two sheets of the paper. One is the list of those things. And then the other side of the paper is the tweets and the, kind of going after people and, what he says day to day, the horse face and the, all the other stuff. So there's two sheets of the paper. And I think that depending on how Democrats finally get their nominee, will depend on how independents and conservative Republicans look at those two sheets of paper. And they'll focus on this side if it's Bernie Sanders, and they'll look kind of at different sides depending on who it is.
Mara?
Yeah. Everything, it's funny. Every single thing we talk about now we can talk about it in one way, then we can talk about it if Bernie is the nominee. It kind of changes everything. I mean, if Bernie Sanders is the nominee, Donald Trump and the Republicans have the opportunity of the century to reach out to the middle, which he has so far completely refused to do. Most presidents try to expand their coalition. Donald Trump took what some people call a cable news business model, which is, doesn't matter how many people are watching you so long as they're tuned to you 24/7. In other words, he just wanted to intensify his base, get them more and more energetic, try to find other people who are just like his base demographically, and get them to turn out for him. But he wasn't interested in expanding his coalition. But Bernie Sanders will give him an opportunity to do that. Bernie Sanders could be the best thing that could happen to the Republican Party, because without him, they are facing some long-term demographic problems.
But I will say that judicial reform and the efforts he's made recently to reach out to African-American communities, I think, is a signal that they are trying to shave 2, 3, 4 points.
Well, Bernie will help them do that, and maybe even more.
Constituencies.
Yeah.
All right, let's turn to the questions from the audience. Let's start with this one. When de Tocqueville visited the United States, he was impressed by the level of debate by informed citizens of every class. The founders thought this sort of debate was necessary for a republic. How did we lose that, and how do we get it back?
Well, I always say this. One way we get it back is by having K through 12 civics education, where people would learn how to have an argument without demonizing their opponents or thinking that they are traitors and treasonous just because they disagree with them. I mean, having a civil discourse where you agree on a set of facts and then explain why you have two very different opinions about what to do about those facts is something that's an important, it's kind of like a little d democratic muscle that has to be exercised, otherwise it atrophies and we just start shouting at each other and nothing ever gets done.
I think social media has played to the extremes, and social media, you know, really adds to that level of bad discourse. There are a few groups out there that are making headway. One is called Listen First, and that is to listen first to your opponents, even if you're diametrically opposed ideologically, to just listen to the argument and make your argument, but be civil about it. And it really is, it takes a lot of teaching to our kids to start that, because adults on social media, you can just look at my Twitter feed and I'm happy to provide evidence to.
I would just add, I mean, I think the responsibility is ours. I think we can begin in our own social interactions when we go out to dinner with friends and family. How can we model having a discussion where you don't have to avoid a discussion about politics, because it's so fraught between you? You know, if you're getting a lot of your news from stuff that, you know, friends and family send you on Facebook, challenge yourself to read something or watch something that you disagree with, and start to identify people from different points of view who have a point. That it's what Secretary Panetta talked about. We have to be able to listen to each other. We have to demonstrate how to break out of our own information silos if we're gonna get much traction, because if we don't do that, then we get locked in. You know, it's very easy to delegitimize people you don't know. You know, you think about someone who might be accused of sexual predation in some way or sexual harassment. And if it's somebody that you know, you're willing to say, gosh, this person should get a fair process. I don't believe this is true. Like, you know, there's just more humanity. But if it's this distant figure in Washington, you're like, oh, totally wrong, probably, you know, a rapist. Let's oppose that person. So we need a little bit more kind of up close and personal connection to avoid that proclivity to delegitimize other views.
Okay, this one deals with, you know, Russian interference in our election. From the media's introspective from 2016, are you ready to be more careful about not dispensing Russian disinformation to the public?
That's a great question. I wish some of us worked for Twitter or Google or Facebook, because that's
right.
Where the real problem is.
I don't think to spread any more.
That's really a question for the social media companies, because, you know, the problem is that the business model of social media, the algorithms, tend to promote extreme content, because that's what keeps you online longer so they can sell more ads. It's kind of the only conspiracy you'll find online is the one to keep you online looking for conspiracies. So it's a real problem. I don't know if the media can report on false information without spreading it further, but the social media companies are really have to step up.
Yeah, I look at my job as a news anchor to be in part an ice hockey goalie to try to prevent the bad pucks from getting through. And there are a lot of bad pucks out there with everything that's out there. And it's increasing in technological effort. These things called deep fakes are actually videos of a politician speaking, but it's not that person. And suddenly it pops up, and you think it's a soundbite from some event, but it's not. It's a Russian or Chinese or Israeli. As the secretary knows, there's a lot of different countries that are looking to sow chaos in our election process. So I think we have a responsibility to do our job and to be the ice hockey goalie, but you all also have a responsibility to kind of, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I should look at something else.
That's the hardest part, is I think it's less important what the news media does in that respect than what is being consumed generally, that are these deep fakes or manipulated videos. So I think we have to try to balance. The problem is you just don't know. I mean, what a lot of this disinformation is pushing on open doors where we're already having these debates with each other and then kind of going down that alley and producing more. I think that's where the government's got to play a role in trying to regulate this as well, which they haven't been very good at doing.
You know, in a low-trust society, if you don't trust the media and you don't trust the government, who do you trust? You trust your Facebook friends group. That's where you find out that Barack Obama was not born in the United States, or vaccines cause autism,
right,
or Hillary Clinton was running a pedophilia ring from a pizza parlor in D.C. I mean, you know, it's a problem.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as having been in the intelligence business, the purpose of intelligence is to speak truth to power. You don't need an intelligence service if you don't want to hear the truth. And very frankly, the truth and facts are incredibly important to leaders like the president being able to make the right decisions. Otherwise, they're operating on fantasy. And you're likely to get the wrong decisions. The intelligence services have all said what the Russians are doing. And we know that that's a fact. Give me a sense of why does the president resist being able to kind of stand up and say the Russians are doing this, and we're going to make clear to the Russians that they're not going to get away with it?
You know, his people say that. You know, you're Secretary right. Pompeo says that. Yeah. His national security advisor says that. He, I think, feels under siege and feels like any indication that Russia somehow helped him diminishes his electoral win in 2016 or diminishes his win if he wins in 2020. You know, the story about the other day, about this briefing up on Capitol Hill, I mean, it was nuanced. It wasn't as cut and dry as people, like, shorthanded it. Essentially, the president found out that there was this briefing to the Intelligence Committee on Capitol Hill, the Democrats run by Adam Schiff, who had just been an impeachment manager making this case on the Senate floor, and he was briefed, and they were briefed about this before the president was briefed, is what I understand.
Yeah, that was a mistake.
And that right there, I think, it builds this thing in the president's mind that he's under siege. And at some point, there is some element of truth to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that the intelligence community this isn't the first time we've heard this. I mean, they said after 2016, we think the Russians will do it again. They've said periodically, we think the Russians are still trying. Yeah, so it wasn't news. You know, Mueller cataloged what they were trying to do. And it's interesting. Bernie Sanders, who, of course, you know, took umbrage at this and said he doesn't want any Russian help and, you know, he's no friend of Putin, blah, blah, blah. One of the things that you have seen happen after the president got mad about not being briefed first is that now the White House is saying the Russians want to help Bernie, not us.
So, but isn't it weird that Bernie Sanders didn't say anything for a month and a half
Look,
after getting briefed?
So
I mean, what's that?
What's that? And he was asked about it. Why did you wait a month? And he said, I don't like to talk about classified briefings or something like that. And then someone asked him, why do you think it broke just now? And the Washington Post says they ran the story when they got the story. But Bernie said, well, why do you think it broke on the day of the Nevada caucuses? It's from the Washington Post. They're not my friends. Or he said, good friends. Right. It was a very kind of...
In other words,
yeah,
they're fake news.
Yeah, they're fake news. It was very Trumpian. Right. You know, he didn't say enemy of the people, but he did, or human scum, but, you know, he did... He did lash out at the message.
Okay, Trump and the leading Democratic candidates are both farther right and farther left than where the two parties used to stand generally. Are candidates on the extreme outside of the party the new norm? Does that mean the primary system is broken? How will these sorts of candidates and primaries affect governance in America? A lot of questions.
That's a really good question.
So I said earlier to, yeah, there was a similar question earlier with the kids, and they were really great questions, by the way. They were really good. But I said that the traditional system is that for Democrats, you know, they go to Iowa and it's very progressive, super progressive. And they go to New Hampshire, it's a little bit more libertarian, but very progressive. They go to South Carolina, it's about the Black Caucus. They go to Nevada, it's about kind of open immigration. Republicans go to Iowa, it's about social conservatives. They go to New Hampshire, you cannot tax a thing. You go to South Carolina, it's about the military, all the military. And you go to Nevada, and it's about build the wall. Now, on those two parties, in the first four states, they are drawn to their extremes to fire up the base in the primary and caucus system. Traditionally, it has been that in a general election, they come back to the middle and they play for the middle. But less and less. Yeah. That's happening less and less.
I believe the primary system on the Democratic side will be changed. I think the Nevada Democratic Party actually came out with a statement saying, we're ready to move to a primary. We don't want to have a caucus. There are two issues here. One is, should they be the first four states that go first? Iowa, that's 91% white. New Hampshire, that's 93% white. And then there's the issue of the caucuses in Iowa and Nevada. A caucus is not a secret ballot. A caucus makes it harder, since at least in Iowa you have to go and stand there for several hours, makes it harder for women with children to go. There's all sorts of issues. After the debacle in Iowa, I think there's a tremendous amount of pressure in the Democratic Party to change the way they start off their primary, their nominating process. What exactly will happen? Will they have a bunch of states go first on the same day? Will they have a bigger states go first? I don't know, but I do think we've come to the end of, at least on the Democratic side, of this current system.
But the front part of that question is about whether the parties are moving, and I think the parties are moving.
Yes.
I certainly think the Democratic Party has moved left. I mean, it's, you know, the notion that even with the primary structure, you know, Bernie Sanders had a huge voter mobilization among Latino voters, which helped him tremendously in Nevada. He's pulling up to Biden in polling with African-American voters in South Carolina. So, you know, it may just be that he is, nobody wants to hear this yet, but I just want to let the voters speak. He may be the more mainstream part of the party in terms of who actually shows up and votes if he can get a bigger coalition. The notion that on health care alone, the movement from 2008 to 2020 in the Democratic Party shows you that that would have been, what would have been judged extreme, taxation as well, is much more mainstream in the Democratic Party.
I interviewed President Obama a week before Obamacare passed in the House, and one of the questions was, is this, the Affordable Care Act, the camel's nose under the tent for essentially government-run health care? Well, it's no longer the camel's nose. The whole camel is in the tent. He's just in there. Because Medicare for All is essentially everything. It's a total evolution from where 2010 was for the Democratic Party. On the Republican Party, there is an abandonment of concern about deficit and debt. Remember that Paul Ryan, as vice presidential nominee, and Mitt Romney as Republican nominee, campaigned in front of a debt clock.
Yeah.
They campaigned in front of the debt clock.
They warned about
it. Remember the commercials where Paul Ryan's pushing the wheelchair over the cliff? And, you know, they said, what are you going to do to grandma? That's because Republicans thought that that was a real issue that people cared about. Donald Trump said, no, we're going to grow our way through this. And at some point, you have to turn the aircraft carrier. And I know I've covered you talking about this ad nauseum, both Republicans and Democrats concerned about it. It's, you got to do something at some point.
But wait till the next recession we have no fiscal policy.
The biggest concern I have now is that Republicans and Democrats don't want to talk about the debt where the deficit.
Yeah.
We've got a deficit of over $1 trillion. We've got a debt of over $24 trillion.
Yeah. So how are you going to pay for $60
trillion? Yeah.
For Bernie Sanders' program.
Exactly. Right.
Can I say one thing about mandatory Medicare for All, because that's the Bernie program. Medicare for All is very vague. When people hear Medicare for All, they think, hey, I can have Medicare if I want it. That's not what Bernie's plan is. His plan is mandatory Medicare, no more private health insurance, and it's Medicare for everyone. Now, polls show, and David is right, something like 6 in 10 of voters in Nevada in exit polls said they were for Medicare for All. Then they were asked some follow-up questions. And when they found out there would be no more private health insurance, nope, I don't want that. So there's a lot of confusion about where the public is on health care. They want drug prices to come down. They want, many of them, want to be able to buy Medicare if that's what they want. But remember, people don't like big changes in their health care system. That's why in 2010 and 2014, the Democrats did so badly in the midterms, because Obamacare was on the ballot. It was only after Obamacare went into existence and Republicans tried to take it away that the tables were turned and the Republicans suffered in 2018 because of health care. Here comes Bernie Sanders coming to take away the best issue the Democrats had for them in 2018,
right,
health care, and he's going to give it to the Republicans.
The one thing we should say that, you know, we can be very substantive, but these things may never come to pass. What I think is important in a politics of anger, at an angry time, is that candidate with fight. It's like what they, you know, when FDR was president and people were discouraged about the depression and whatnot, they still had great faith that he was there. And in a politics of anger, the idea that Trump is willing to fight and demonize, they like the fight. And I think people like that about Bernie Sanders as well. They're not thinking about whether this is ever going to come to pass, but that he's willing to make the fight.
Well, wait, explain Elizabeth Warren. She was Miss Fight, Fight, Fight.
Well,
I mean, that's what she said 100 times in every stump speech.
Yeah, right. Well, she lost Sanders, the fighter.
Let me move on to this question. Congress's inability to work together in a bipartisan legislative effort has increased. Do you think that setting term limits on Congress would help create more opportunities for innovative leaders? Let me just add to that. I think the reality is that whether it's Trump or whether it's Sanders, you know, even if it's a moderate Democrat, they're going to have a hell of a time governing, particularly with a divided Congress. And how are we going to avoid another 4 years of gridlock? Because the likelihood is that Bernie's program is not going to wind up being adopted by the House or the Senate. You know, he'll be stuck like Trump has been stuck, and he's going to turn to executive orders and talking and pounding a shoe on the table. How do we get Washington back to governing and working together in order to deal with the issues facing this country?
I don't know that term limits is the answer. I think it's because I think part of the problem is that it's become, you know, a dirty business to legislate and to work with your colleagues and to hang out in Washington and to, you know, have a kid who plays Little League, and then you talk on the outskirts of the game. You know, now it's sleeping in cots in your office because you want to so openly show your disdain for the institution. I think we have to change the incentive structure. You should want, you know, a Leon Panetta, Jimmy Panetta, to go to Washington to go and work with his colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, to actually get things done for your communities back home. And I think that's what's been lost. So, and I think, again, there's aspects of the media that disincentivize that, but I don't know that you want experienced people. I mean, to all of a sudden yank somebody out just as they're getting the hang of the thing, I don't think that's the answer.
Yeah, I think that if you listed all the things the Democrats and Republicans agree on Capitol Hill, it's actually a long list. They get to some point and then they go to their corners because there's some issue that happens and they can't politically get to what they really do agree on. To your point earlier, infrastructure, I mean, infrastructure should happen. It should be a bipartisan thing.
Yeah.
I wrote a book about Eisenhower. It's called 3 Days in January, Dwight Eisenhower's final mission.
Available on Amazon.
3 Days at the Brink's about FDR. It's also available on Amazon. No. But Eisenhower was our most bipartisan president. He worked with Sam Rayburn in the House and Lyndon Johnson in the Senate and did some really big things, including the national highway system that we drive on today. And we just don't have many Eisenhowers out there.
You know,
we could use a few more.
The two most popular governors in America right now, just by approval ratings, are Larry Hogan and Charlie Baker, Republican governors of blue states, Maryland and Massachusetts. That tells you that as people want the two parties to work together. Now, they do keep on voting for people who go to Washington and don't work together, but I think voters like it when people work across the aisle.
And I'm not sure that a Donald Trump in a second term, and I don't know this for a fact, wouldn't try to get big things done because it's about his legacy. In other words, infrastructure, or who knows, maybe immigration, or something big that has his name on it. I don't think it's going to be Simpson Bowles, but
no, certainly not.
And deficit debt, but I think there might be an effort to do something big.
There's a lot of focus on the strengthened executive branch versus the legislative, but is the high turnover in the cabinet reducing the effectiveness of the executive branch?
Of this executive branch, yes. Yeah, the executive writ large, maybe not. But yeah, this executive branch, yeah, there's so many empty positions. And what happens if we have a pandemic? And
right.
Yeah, there's...
That's actually what scares me the most. I mean, about this president, his impulsiveness, and the fact that I just don't believe he has the best people around him. And I think, you know, we covered, covering the ins and outs of the Iraq War, one of the things that where there was a real breakdown, and people in the Bush administration will tell you, is a very dry-sounding term, the interagency process. But that's what really matters. It's how agencies that are, who are tasked with implementing these policies, how they actually do. So whether it's responding to a viral contagion like coronavirus or financial contagion, you know, you want good people there, and you need to listen to those people. That's the breakdown I worry about right now.
Well, but I mean, it's pretty obvious that President Trump doesn't want strong people around him.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
I think the loudest, you know, voices in the cabinet have not stuck around. General Kelly obviously was trying to really lock things down. I will say there's turnover in other administrations. There were a few defense secretaries in the Obama administration.
But nothing at this
after
level.
Me.
After you. After you. But I think that nothing like this, nothing like these numbers.
Yeah.
And I think that, frankly, this president runs it how he wants to run it. And we'll see. I think that is there a big voice in that White House? Mick Mulvaney is not that voice.
Not now. Mick Mulvaney, who gave a speech in England, Oxford, recently, saying that this country is desperate for immigrants. We need as many of them as we can get. And he said the quiet part out loud. He said Republicans only care about deficits when there's a Democratic president.
Right. No, it's very much, you know, it's very much
this the outside voice.
Right. This is what the president wants done. Now your job is to figure out, you know, how you get it done, as opposed to speaking truth to power and managing. Again, you know, the intelligence community has lots of problems and has over the years. But to have a complete breakdown there where you say, oh, I just can't trust these people because they're out to get me. And then the bureaucracy of justice is out to get me. I mean, it really is paranoid.
I mean, he's had a few people that stay the whole time. Steve Mnuchin has been Treasury Secretary since the beginning. Wilbur Ross at Commerce. There's a few people that have been since the beginning, but there are very few. And it's really, really turned over quite a bit.
Brett, let me ask you something. I asked this in an earlier session. Here's President Trump, and he's just gone through the process with the Mueller report, and it's pretty clear that at the end of the Mueller investigation, he's not going to be impeached. Congress doesn't have the steam to really do that, and Pelosi basically decides that she's not going to get anywhere on that. The day after Mueller testifies, The President of the United States picks up the phone, calls the President of the Ukraine, and asks him to investigate a political opponent. I mean, as Chief of Staff, when a President makes a mistake, what you try to do is to make damn sure that that President never makes that mistake again, and that you're going to say, don't do that. But clearly that didn't happen here. Was Trump not thinking about that? Was he just thinking there's nothing wrong here for me to do that, or that I can get away with it? I mean, what motivates him to do that so soon to the investigation, the Mueller investigation?
Why, Brett, why?
Anyway, that book's available on Amazon. Listen, I think that the biggest issues for this administration, for this president, are things that he has caused himself. The biggest storm that has created are from things that he shot himself in the foot.
Yeah.
He creates the storm, then figures out a way to get out of it, and gets out of it and says, see, I got out of this storm, but the beginning storm was because of something that happened of what he did. Now, I think it's that's just who he is. That's how I think he ran some of his business. I think, you know, it's that kind of thought process. I don't know that there's a lot of people in that White House that have the ability to say, you know, don't do that. I think maybe Ivanka has that.
I don't know, but I mean, the thought that Donald Trump would say, see some polling on Joe Biden, very good, feeling, you know, worried about Joe Biden, and he thinks, you know, he's thinking about all the stuff about Ukraine, this and that. Maybe Rudy Giuliani gave him the idea. You know, let's get the Ukrainians to say they're opening an investigation. That would really, you know, undermine Joe Biden. That sounds like a good idea. I don't know if it ever enters Trump's head. Is that the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do? Or is that something that, you know, I mean, I don't know if that ever enters his head. I think he's very focused on winning and doing whatever it takes to win. And I think after Mueller, he had to have felt emboldened. It wasn't just that the Mueller report did not they certainly weren't going to indict him because they thought that he couldn't be indicted. But the Mueller report, you know, gave him what he considered to be, you know, a full exoneration. It wasn't just that. It was that Bob Mueller was on television the day before and did badly on television.
Right.
I mean, you can't discount that. Remember, he gave a halting performance, and performing on TV is the kind of metric for Donald Trump. You know, Bob Mueller, the guy who tortured him for 2 years, looked like, you know, he was an old fuddy-duddy on television. And so maybe Trump is just feeling full of oats.
I think his persona across his life, his public life, in the tabloids as a real estate developer, someone who, when he was facing bankruptcy, told banks to take a walk. If you live your life and in a personal fashion without limits and without boundaries, and that's worked for you, you're going to bring that into the sphere, especially because there's all of this reinforcement for no limits, no boundaries. He gets reinforced by that in the political realm. He's not going to listen to the gatekeepers who say, no, presidents aren't supposed to act like this, because he says exactly. Because even when he looks bad in the media or otherwise, it all feeds the persona that has generally been rewarded because he was elected president of the United States. And I think it feeds into all of that, Secretary Panetta. I think that call to Ukraine, I think he gets motivated by the idea that there are real scandals that the press and that his opponents won't get to the bottom of, and that he operates by loyalty and vengeance, and he wants to get to the bottom of.
I will say that he figures out how to get to a W, how to get to a win, whether it's in his mind or it's in the population's mind. But right now, as we sit here today, he's at 50% approval in Gallup. He's at the highest approval on the economy that we've seen. This is after the impeachment that we just went through. This is after 2 years of Russia that we just went through, the investigation. He is in a position to win re-election. And, you know, it's interesting to watch the cycle. And what happens is he does something that really throws people off, and they're like, how can this possibly be happening? And then the media says, this is unbelievable, and then there's outrage about it, and then there's pointing to the outrage, can you believe they're getting this upset about this? And then it's full circle, and then on the other side, he says, you know, it's all fake news, it's the press, they're after me. And then people go, well, yeah.
You've just described his life history. Let me ask you this. We've gone full we used to have full transparency on health and taxes for a president. And now we have a president who doesn't want to disclose his taxes or his health information. And now Bernie Sanders is pretty much doing the same. If a president has a bad heart or physical problem, shouldn't the public be entitled to that information?
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. And the thing that's amazing is that, you know, Bernie Sanders is, I don't want to say he's like Trump ideologically, of course he's not, but he has done a lot of Trumpian things. He said he would release his medical records, and now, nope, he's not going to. And Donald Trump said famously over and over again he was going to release his tax returns. That's not going to happen. There's no law that says you have to. And it was a norm that all presidents did, but that norm has been broken.
Yeah, and I think that's the age we're really living in. We see it in our communities. I mean, you know, whether it's, you know, how out of fashion calling an adult Mr. or Mrs., you know, or other things that we considered norms of public behavior by the politicians and other public figures has been undermined by all of the things.
David,
that
let me just stop you. We've got about a minute and a half.
Okay.
I just want to quickly. Who's going to win the November election? Very quickly.
It's hard to make predictions, especially Dave, about the future, but you'd have to say at this point it looks like Trump.
Yeah,
like,
I think Trump wins. Yeah. Really.
How about Brett?
If it's Bernie.
So I do Candidate Casino, $100 in chips. I'd say $70 on Trump, $30 on Bernie.
Yeah, that's good.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. Let's all go out and get a drink. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for being here. I think we do face a lot of challenges, but I put my greatest trust in you, the people, to make the right decision. And if you do that, I'm absolutely confident that we will protect the republic that all of us love. Thank you very much for having us this evening.